Okay, good morning, everyone. Before we start, yeah, we ready? Before we start, this is the last Thursday morning of this term. Then we have Pesach to experience, and then the week after Pesach, we won't have a shiur. We're going to start again on the 15th of April. It's Thursday, 15th of April. Topic to be advised. Haven't worked it out yet. Okay. So Pesach's around the corner. Pesach, the Pesach experience, the Seder, is obviously very deeply connected to everyone. I once read a statistic that the Seder is the most observed Jewish ritual, more than Yom Kippur even, which is interesting. Well, I can tell you, I don't know why. Historically in culture, I don't know why, but I can tell you why spiritually. In other words, spiritually, because we are taught that the Seder is really about our birth, like who we are as a nation. The prophet Ezekiel refers to the Exodus from Egypt as the birth of the Jewish nation. And the foundation, the faith, the connection to God, becoming a nation, was all started with the story of Pesach. So I suppose that's the idea. However, to really fully experience Pesach in a proper way and to connect to it, what it really means is really needs a bit of preparation. I saw just parenthetically, I saw a little cute idea, you know, that we eat, or some people eat the egg on the Pesach night, right? When I say some people, because you don't have to actually, it's much more important to eat matzah. Less tastier, but more important to eat matzah on Pesach night. We have on the Seder plate, we have the egg. I know in South Africa, growing up, this was like a hugely important ritual to eat the egg afterwards with salt water. Yeah. Don't want to break it to you, but it's actually not that important, but it's I mean, you can go.
It's a South African thing.
No. It's a universal. I mean, no, we do it also. I do eat the egg. But it's not halachically not the most binding important thing to do on the Pesach. Much more important to eat a big piece of shmura matzah by the Seder, hand-baked shmura matzah. If you don't have any, let me know.
Sells, if grandma doesn't say it,
No, we don't sell. Actually, we don't make any money out of it. It's not.
When
I can arrange you some. No. It was on the emails. And I was about to say.
Thank you.
So if you don't have any, please let me know, because it's really important. That's the really important thing to do, which we're going to talk about in a moment. However, it is a custom to have the egg on the Seder plate, and a lot of people do eat it with salt water as part of the meal. So I read a little cute idea. There's many, many reasons why we have the egg, why we eat it, and so on and so forth. But one cute idea I saw is the Talmud says about eggs when they're laid, which is part of another very complex Talmudic passage I'm not going to go into now. But the Talmud makes a comment that when an egg is laid, it is already finished and completed the day before. So when the chicken incubates the egg, it actually is laid a day after it's finished. Right? So therefore, the concept there is that when it comes, if you want the egg to be laid on Pesach, it's a reminder, it's a symbol. You have to prepare for it the day before. In other words, you have to prepare for it leading up to the festival. Only then you can really fully experience the festival, which is why today we're going to do some concepts, discuss some of the concepts, some of the formulae which are really part of the Seder experience, to try and give it a bit more depth. Of course, it's all based on the concept which we've mentioned hundreds of times, and that is that in Judaism, we don't celebrate history, we re-experience history, we try to experience the energy of what is going on in that particular festival. And every festival becomes a journey. Every festival becomes something that's in the air, something that's there for us to really experience and to connect to. And when we sit down to the Seder, we are taught Kabbalistically that the Seder has tremendous holiness to it and tremendous energy to it, which if we connect to it on some level, it helps us experience what Pesach is supposed to teach us, right? Or supposed to give us, so to speak. And that is, of course, and I gave a shiur on this the other night, and I'm not going to repeat it, don't worry. Okay, so that's exactly so. But all Pesach shiurim have to start this way, and that is that the theme of Pesach, of course, is freedom, inner freedom, spiritual freedom. When we talk about the Jews being in Egypt for 210 years, and much of that time was spent in slavery, we're actually not only referring to the physical slavery, we're referring to the spiritual slavery. And therefore, the Exodus from Egypt, essentially, for the Jewish people to become a nation, the very first ingredient was spiritual freedom, inner freedom, personal freedom, and so on. And we are taught that all the Jews were given that gift of freedom on Pesach, including those Jews that aren't even born. Now, one of the ways, just in the Haggadah, I'll just share with you an interesting, I'm sure I've done this before, but just a quick thought that brings out this concept. We tell a story in the Haggadah, it's one of the paragraphs in the Haggadah, about five rabbis that sat in Bnei Brak and told the story of the exodus from Egypt the entire night, right? To bring out the importance of retelling the story. If you examine who those rabbis were, it's very interesting because we are taught that in Egypt, the Jews were divided into 12 tribes, coming from the 12 sons of Jacob. And the one tribe that actually was not enslaved, and there's a whole background to why, but they were not under slavery. They were trapped in Egypt, but they weren't working as slaves, was the tribe of Levi, which comprises of Kohanim and Levi'im, right? So if you look at the five rabbis, they're one of three people. Some of them, one or two of them were Kohanim, the other one were Levi'im, and Rabbi Akiva came from converts, which means the five rabbis, none of their ancestors actually worked hard in Egypt. None of them were enslaved. And yet they were telling the story, which brings out the point that it's actually not about the physical slavery, it's about the spiritual slavery. Because we were all enslaved. Our souls were all enslaved. We were trapped in ourselves. And Pesach gave us the ability, the gift, to be truly free. Now, of course, what does truly free mean? As we again, always describe when we come around Pesach. So freedom is a very, very important term to understand. It's not what the modern world thinks freedom is. Freedom is about choice, but not the type of choice that people normally talk about when they talk about choice. Often when people talk about choice, it's about I am who I am, I own myself, and I do what I want. That's actually not choice, and that's not freedom. That's slavery. That means we're trapped in ourselves. So I have temptations, I have weaknesses, I have struggles, and I'm just who I am. Accept me the way I am. This is me, and too bad. So that's slavery. That's not choice. That's not freedom. True freedom, true choice, is the ability to choose what I don't want to be, meaning to go beyond myself, to free myself from myself, to choose to do something which is either morally correct or beneficial for me in terms of my human experience in the long term, which connects me to something higher and deeper and more meaningful, even though it goes against what I want now, what I believe is going to be pleasurable or good for me in the now. That's what freedom is. So freedom is that although I'm disposed to acting and responding a certain way, but I choose not to do that, right? That's freedom. Now, of course, that comes through many different aspects. We talked about it the other night. It comes through understanding it, because we know the power of the mind is to be able to make choice, like Edith Eger talks about, what her mother told her, that no one can take away what's in your mind, because, you know, as Viktor Frankl spoke about, I mean, there's all modern stuff, of course, but very in line with ancient Jewish thinking, that if you have a stimulus and you respond in a particular way, normally we want to respond emotionally the way we want to. So an example, if someone says something to us that we don't like, we will get angry. That's what we want to do. That's an emotional response. But if we pause and we think about it and we understand what is right, then we'll make the right choice, even though it's hard for us. But what we're doing then, that's just a simple example. What we're doing in that example is we're freeing ourselves from ourselves. In other words, myself, the I, wants me to respond negatively, which will make me feel good for the now. Like people say, you know, I let him have it. You heard the expression? Like, I let him have it. I used to say, like, now I feel better. Do you really feel better? No. Is it good for you? No. Is it good for him? Is it good for him? Also not. Is it effective? Did it achieve a goal? All of that, nothing. It just made me feel better. So freedom means, no, I choose not to do that. I choose to go beyond myself, to connect to something deeper, to connect to my soul, to my faith, whatever the case is, and make the right choice, right? And so many examples of that. That's how life plays out. So we know there's certain things that I should do, whether it's spiritual connection, whether it's a mitzvah, whether it's personal growth, whether it's emotional health, whatever the case is, there's lots of things that we know we should do, and it's not our nature, it's not our disposition, or it's, and it goes back to the whole chesed and gvura discussion. It might not even be terrible things, it just might be that I have a personality that is one way, but then the situation calls for a different response, and that's hard, and that's true freedom, to be able to do that. Okay. So what I want to do today, I'm ahead of myself here, it's not the same idea. Relax.
Or behind
yourself. Yeah, exactly. So what I want to do this morning, that is to have a look at some of the Seder, parts of the Seder, parts of the Haggadah, and understand it on a deeper level so we understand the message that the Haggadah is telling us about the ingredients that allow us to be truly free. Okay? So, let me start with this. Step one of freedom, true freedom that is to believe that you can be free. That's step one. Although, if we don't have that, then there's nothing to talk about. Now, it sounds very simple, but it's obviously not, because most people actually really believe they can't be free. Right? Free in the sense. Right? Often people tell you, no, it's too difficult for me. It's not me. I can't do this. It doesn't gel with me. It doesn't talk to me. It's too hard. It's not my nature, and so on and so forth, right? But part of the step, therefore the step one to be truly free is to actually believe that we can. We can do it. We can overcome the struggle. There is a struggle. We'll talk about that later. But it's hard. But we can. We have the ability. We have it within us. We have a soul that God gave us. We have a spark that craves meaning, as Viktor Frankl likes to describe it. And we can. We can do it. It's hard. It's a struggle. Some of us take huge effort. We don't always succeed. We make progress. We don't have to reach perfection. But we can do it, right? Now, let me give you just three examples of where that is so beautifully expressed in the story of the Exodus from Egypt and some of the aspects of the Haggadah. So the first thing is a sentence which we actually quote in the Haggadah. Some people miss it because it's towards the end of the Haggadah when everyone's already hungry and wants to get to the meal. But when we talk about the plagues, actually. So it's a sentence from the Torah. It's actually a sentence that's in every day's prayers, really. It's about when the Jews crossed the sea and they came out of Egypt. And it says there, "Vayaminu b'Hashem uv'Moshe avdo." And the Jews believed in God and Moses, his servant, right? Now, there's a lot to talk about in the sentence. What does it mean? And why is it so important? In other words, they believed in God. Yes, Moses took us out of Egypt. That is true. But what does it mean they believed in Moses? They don't believe in Moses. We believe in God, obviously, right? Now, of course, we have this concept in Jewish tradition that we have tzaddikim, we have righteous people who guide us and who inspire us, and they're on a higher level. And there is a concept in Judaism called emunat tzaddikim, which is to believe in the tzaddikim, to believe in the higher powers that they have, and so on and so forth. But that's not the discussion I wanted to have. I wanted to share with you a thought from the Kotzker Rebbe, which I just saw recently. I try to learn new things in the Haggadah every year, so this is a beautiful idea. And he says the following. He says, you know why it's so important to believe... Sorry, not the Kotzker Rebbe. That's right. Reb Tzadok HaKohen, one of the great Hasidic Rebbes. Reb Tzadok HaKohen is called. And he says the following. He says that if a person really wants to go out of Egypt, you have to believe in God, obviously, because you have to believe in a higher power. You have to believe in the God-given gift that He's given you. You also have to believe in yourself. You have to believe that you can do it. And he says, that's why it says they believed in God and in Moses. What was so special about Moses? Because Moses believed in the Jewish people. We see this time and time again in the Torah. Who always fought for the Jewish people even when they failed? Who even, so to speak, fought with God on behalf of the Jewish people? When the Jewish people failed, Moses. He was a true leader. A true leader believes in the people that he's following or she's following, right? A true leader trusts that even when people make mistakes, but they can rise again. When the Jews sinned with the golden calf, Moses went all out. Many, many instances in the Chumash where the Jews messed up, and they messed up plenty, because they were human beings, like all of us. They complained, they argued, they all sorts of things. And God... And Moshe Rabbeinu fought. He went out on a limb. He fought with God, so to speak. He says, no, you can't punish them. You've got to forgive them. You're a forgiving God. What are people going to say? That you just get angry? All these kind of things. Why? Because Moshe Rabbeinu, even to the point where by the golden calf, where God threatened to destroy the Jewish people with the exception of Moses, and he said, I'll make you into a great nation. He says, if you destroy them, you take me out of the whole Torah. Erase me from your book. That's what he said. Right? Because that's a true leader. And Moshe Rabbeinu was a true leader. Says Rav Tzadok HaKohen, he says, "Vayaminu ba'Hashem." If you really want to experience Egypt, going out of Egypt, you got to trust, you got to believe in God. But you also have to believe in Moses. Why do you believe in Moses? Because Moses believes in you. And therefore, if you believe in Moses, you'll understand how Moses looks at you and you'll start looking at yourself that way. So that's step one. You got to believe in yourself. You got to believe that you can do it. Belief in God is, of course, critical because that's how we rise above the struggle by understanding the intrinsic faith that we have, the soul that we have. But we also have to believe that we have it. Like the idea of Modeh Ani that I've shared with you many times, that we say, Rabba Amunatecha, God believes in us. But who reveals that belief in us, that trust in us? It's Moses. And that's the idea of Ayaminu Bahashem, they believed in God and in Moses. So that's one idea. A second example of the same concept. You know, at the beginning of the Seder, there's a song that people sing, Kadesh Rechatz, right? There's a 15-step, I want you to call it mnemonic or something, that helps us remember what we're supposed to do throughout the Seder, right? So the truth is that although it's on the surface just a system of remembering what to do, it's a program, it's an index to the Seder, so to speak, but we know that in many, many, many Haggadot in Jewish literature, it talks about the depth of Jewish customs and that there's tremendous depth in that little 15-step thing, right? So I saw an idea just about the first three and how they work one after another, spiritually speaking. Because those 15 steps are not just 15 steps of what to do. Practically, they're also 15 ideas, right? So the first three is Kadesh Urechatz Karpas, right? Kadesh means you make Kiddush, you sanctify the day, you pour the one cup of wine and you sanctify the day. Urechatz is you go wash your hands. And then Karpas, you eat a vegetable. Why do you wash your hands? Halachically, because we want to do something different than the rest of the year to arouse curiosity, or there's a concept of wet vegetables requiring washing, similar to bread, according to some opinions. But that's bottom line. So we wash, and then we eat, because we wash twice on Pesach night, one before the vegetable, one before Hamotzi. So we wash, and then we eat the vegetable. So there's a concept that goes like this. This is the extra part of it is what I saw recently, but the first part is a famous idea. That we know there's two ways to become holy, right? We always, when we sanctify ourselves, when we elevate ourselves, when we refine ourselves, it's always a partnership. It's a partnership between us and God. Meaning we always need God's help, God's support. But we also have to work hard. If you want to sustain holiness, you've got to put in the effort. You can't just rely on God's inspiration. But one of the greatnesses of Pesach is, different to Tishrei and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, one of the greatnesses of the Pesach energy is that just like in times of old, where the Jews were not capable of doing it themselves, they needed God to do the work, right? So too, when it comes to Pesach, there's an energy where God says, I'll start. Normally, I need you to purify yourself first, but this time I'll start. Therefore, the first one on the Seder is Kadesh, holiness. Holiness descends. Holiness is prevalent at the Seder. There's an energy of inspiration that is just there. It doesn't matter what you've done. It doesn't matter where you're holding. It doesn't matter what level you are. It doesn't matter where, you know, where your journey is up to. There's just abundant holiness. The problem with that is that when we're faced with tremendous holiness, if we take it seriously, suddenly the amazing holiness highlights our weaknesses. Highlights the importance for the next step, which Urechatz. Urechatz means now you got to go and wash. Wash off. Let go of your own weaknesses. Let go of your own failings, right? In other words, you didn't realize how trapped you were till now. You didn't realize the need for your own redemption, for your own progress, for your own development. But comes Pesach, God says, okay, let me show you. Kadesh, I'm going to reveal myself. I'm going to send a special energy. But then I want you, Urechatz, and you need to wash yourselves. You need to go and purify, right? You need to sort of work on yourself a little bit. The problem is, when a person realizes they're going to do some work, all of a sudden we can fall into a depression. I've got to work. I've got to elevate myself. I'm in such tzaris. What do you mean? I'm trapped. You know what kind of things I've done? You know what kind of bad person I am? You know what kind of non-spiritual person I am? It's too hard. As soon as if God wants to do the whole job himself, that's great. But if he wants me to sort of start participating, even though he started the ball rolling, he wants me to work, that's too hard. I'm too low. My level is too low to be able to go out of my own personal Egypt. So the Seder says, no, you're not. Look at the next thing, Karpas. What's Karpas? Karpas is a vegetable. What's a vegetable? Any vegetable, by the way. Right? Some people say an onion, some people say a potato, parsley, whatever you use, it's good as long as it's a vegetable. Right? That's the idea. So what's the idea of a vegetable? A vegetable always comes from the ground. Many vegetables are like tif in the ground, they say, like deep in the ground, right? They're, like you say in Yiddish, tif in eretz. They're deep down in the soil, right? Comes Pesach, suddenly this low vegetable that's been lying on the ground has all the yichus, what is it? On the Seder table. It's very important. An important part of the Seder table, right? So the Karpa says, don't worry about where you are. You think you're like a vegetable? You think you're like deep in the ground? You're so low? Look at the Karpas. The Karpas also in the ground. And in a couple of minutes, it's now on the Seder plate. It's very, very prominent. You too, even if you're a Karpas, even if you're a vegetable, even if you're so deep in the ground, the energy of Pesach is believe in yourself. You can do it. You can go out of your own Egypt. You can take the next step. You can grow. It might be difficult, but you could do it. So that's the second way how this concept of believing in ourselves comes in and understanding the power and the gift that we have to be able, yes, to grow and yes, to go out of our comfort zone and to go out of our personal prison and our personal Egypt. Thirdly, in the same theme, I want to just share with you an idea which comes from one of the plagues. And it highlights a general concept as well. And that is, you know, at the Haggadah, we say the 10 plagues, right? A lot of people know it because they drip wine. It's when you take your finger and you put wine out of the cup and so on. So, also that's when the kids do a little play sometimes. You can buy it gold or little figurines where you have all the plagues on your table and so on. Right? So the plagues on a very superficial, simple level were there to punish the Egyptians who kept on refusing to send the Jewish people out. God kept on saying to Moses, please tell them, warn them that they need to send the Bnei Yisrael out of Egypt. They kept on refusing, and therefore they were kept on being smitten by the plagues until the final plague. However, in Kabbalah we learn it's not so simple. It's not just about punishment for Egyptians. If God wanted to punish the Egyptians, there were greater, quicker, and easier methods to do so, right? But it's much more of a spiritual process. And what the plagues are, number one, they have a dual, the Zohar says, they have a dual purpose. The plagues and what the plagues represent is the dismantling of the spiritual, impure infrastructure of Egypt, but also lessons for the progress and the journey of holiness and redemption that the Jews are supposed to experience. Which means we're supposed to derive lessons from each of the plagues for ourselves. What does it mean to us? What does it mean? Like, what part of us are we letting go of so that we can further advance in the journey of growth? So that's true with every plague, but I'll just share with you an idea of one of them, and that is the plague of hail. Just a detail in the Haggadah, but nevertheless an important one. All the details are important. So the plague of hail was the seventh one. And we read in the Chumash, in the commentary, that although all the plagues were miraculous, right, but there was an extra dimension of miracle that happened with the plague of hail. That God sent down these huge hail, whatever you call them, hail blocks, hailstones, thank you, huge hailstones, on the surface to destroy the crops and to destroy the part of the infrastructure of Egypt. But they came down, each hailstone, they were huge apparently, had burning within it a flame of fire, which was incredibly miraculous because, first of all, ice and fire don't really go together. And yet, that's what happened. And the obvious question is, why? In other words, I can understand hailstones because hailstones are destructive, and that was the purpose, to punish Egypt. But what purpose would the flame within the hailstone serve? We have a principle in early sources that God never performs a miracle for nothing. Actually, God created a world to run according to a certain natural system, which He leads and He created and He guides at the same time. But nevertheless, that's a system He wants the world to run with. And therefore, miracles are the exception to the rule, and God performs miracles, or we believe in miracles, but actually He doesn't perform miracles for no purpose. And the flame within the hailstone seems completely unnecessary. But if we understand the plagues on a deeper level, we understand what this is. And this is an idea that the Lubavitch Rebbe once shared, and he said the following. He said, hail is cold. It's icy. It represents a person who's completely like a stone. Has no passion, has no enthusiasm, has no fire, right? Fire is the opposite. Fire represents excitement, represents enthusiasm, passion, and so on. So, a person who's a hailstone, right? Some people look at them like a hailstone. They're completely non-caring, don't seem to have any sensitivity for others, completely cold, completely detached. They seem to lack the capacity to be compassionate, to love, to be to show empathy, and so on and so forth, right? The lesson of the plague of hail is that there's always a fire. Everyone has a fire. It's just sometimes hidden beneath a very thick layer of ice. Number one. And number two, sometimes that fire within us is always there, but it's wrongly channeled. So sometimes the fire that a person might have is directed inwards. It's directed towards self. So they have a lot of excitement, a lot of passion when it comes to their own benefit, with their own interests. Right? So number one, it's hidden. And number two, it's hidden because also it's self-absorbed. So it's egocentric. Right? What's the lesson of Barad? What's the lesson of the hail? The hail is that we need to chip away at the stone. First of all, we need to take away the coldness. And we also have to channel the fire. So in other words, we need to start doing for others. We need to start doing kindness. We need to start going out of ourselves. We need to start just begin the process of growth because we have it within us. So the lesson of the hailstones is that we should never ever say that we don't possess the ability to be passionate, to be excited about growth. We have a fire. Everyone has a fire. Even the biggest hailstone of ice has a fire. It's just hidden and it might be self-absorbed. So we need to turn that around. We need to chip away at the coldness, take it away, reveal the fire and channel it outwards. But we all have it. So those are three ideas where the step one of growth is so important. We need to believe that we can do it. So we believe in Moses, not just God, because we believe in Moses means we're believing in our ability, the way Moses did. We understand Kadesh Ruchatz Karpas, that there's a tremendous holiness and an opportunity for growth at the Seder, which might highlight our weaknesses, but it shouldn't have the effect of sending us into a depression. On the contrary, we should remember the lesson from the Karpas, which is a vegetable in the ground, but yet it becomes very prominent. So too, we can be elevated from Karpas to the Seder table. And then there's the fire and ice, that we all have the fire, we just need to reveal it and to turn it outwards. Okay. Now, that's part one. How do we do this? So we know that, of course, and this is something we've talked about many times, but obviously need to bring it into the formula. And that is the importance of matzah. Now, we know that on Pesach, really the central theme of Pesach is eating matzah, which comes together with the prohibition of chametz, staying away from chametz. Right? What does that symbolize? So we know that matzah is about letting go of ego. Chametz is ego, right? In other words, chametz, not having chametz means not having anything that rises, right? And we all have an ego. I had a very fascinating discussion with someone the other day. I was explaining to him about matzah. So he said, what's matzah made out of? I said, it's made up exactly the same thing that's bread made out of, right? There are five grains that halachically constitute bread, which is wheat, barley, spelt, rye, and oats. And matzah has to be made of one of those five grains. So he was very surprised. He thought matzah was something else. He said, well, if it's the same, so what's the difference between matzah and bread? I said, that's exactly the point, right? It's not two different people. It's the same person. The difference is that chametz rises a little bit, right? So the dough of matzah is the person that's struggling with ego and yet surrenders. Let's go of the ego, right? In other words, you can only make matzah out of something that potentially can become chametz. Right? If you make matzah out of something that can't even become chametz, then it's not matzah. Understand? Matzah has to be something, and that's representative of us. In other words, the point is not for an angel to become selfless. That wasn't the idea. The idea is that us egocentric human beings should let go of our ego. We should struggle to let go of the ego and to become matzah. That's what Pesach is all about. So first of all, we have to let go of the ego, which is not eating chametz, and that's why for 7 days we don't eat bread, we don't eat chametz. Right? We don't even own chametz, actually. That's why there's this form. If someone wants to give me the names afterwards, they can do it. We sell our chametz actually to a non-Jew over Pesach, so we don't even own the chametz, so to speak. Then afterwards we buy it back, hopefully, if he sells it back to us, which he normally does. And then we eat matzah. So what is eating matzah? So eating matzah means so matzah is complete selflessness, complete humility. Where does it come from? Where does it live within our soul? Where is the location of selflessness within us? So it's our faith, it's our spark, it's our neshama. It's the depth of our soul, right? That's why the Zohar refers to matzah as the food of faith. So the Jews, it says in the Medrash that it was in the merit of faith that the Jews left Egypt. What does that mean? You have to understand, when the Jews left Egypt, they were not very spiritually advanced at all. Right? They were a nation of slaves. They had been assimilated within the culture of Egypt. They had been involved and engaged in the idolatry of Egypt. And yet they were able to go out of Egypt. And they still had a lot of work to do, which in the beginning was very accelerated. They got to the giving of the Torah 7 weeks later. But the acceleration resulted in after them failing because they served the golden calf, and there was a whole process afterwards, and so on. Right? So what got them out of it? What was the foundation? The foundation was that they were ready to connect to something higher than them. They were ready to connect to something beyond them, which was their faith. That was emunah. Where does faith live within us? In the very depth of our soul. The same place where our need and our aspiration for living a life of depth and meaning lives. That's where that lives, at the very depth of our neshama, that spark of our soul. That's why matzah, we are taught when we eat matzah, and on the first night, second night also, it needs to be specially made matzah called shmura matzah, right? Which is specially baked for the mitzvah. When we eat a big piece of shmura matzah by the Seder, that's the physical act of connecting, but obviously it just can't only be the physical act, it's got to be, the more we understand what it means, the better, but it symbolizes, and we try to reflect on that when we eat the matzah, of tapping into that purity that we have. We all have it. We all have a soul. We all have the ability to be selfless. We all have the ability to go beyond ourselves, as we said before. But we have to reveal it. What do we have to reveal? That spark of selflessness, that spark of soul that we have within us, that allows us to go beyond ourselves, that allows us to free ourselves from ourselves. That spark at the depth of our soul, which is a divine spark, as we've talked about many times, which has a spirit and an energy of infinity to it, to allow us to go beyond our nature, beyond our personality, beyond who we are, to grow beyond our comfort zone, and so on and so forth. That all lives in that spark, in that connection that we have to God, which is at the depth of our soul, which is the root of our faith, and that's what matzah represents. And that's why we eat matzah, and we try to connect to the message that matzah gives us. But in order to do that, we also need to see the need to do that. And that's why on Pesach night, we don't only eat matzah, we eat bitter herbs. Bitter herbs, why do we do that? Obviously, the simple reason is because it's always good to remember where you came from and not take your freedom for granted. And that's why we always remember the bitter times that the Jewish people had in Egypt. But on a deeper level, maror comes from the word mar, to be bitter, to be uncomfortable. And in fact, the halakha says that you have to feel the taste of the maror. It's an interesting little law, which resembles a beautiful idea. In other words, it says that if you take maror and you just swallow it without chewing it, you haven't fulfilled the mitzvah. Because you have to chew the maror and feel it. You've got to feel the whatever it is, the bitterness of it, right? Interesting, unfortunately, last year there was actually a fascinating, this is totally off the topic, but just interesting nevertheless, there was a fascinating halachic question that arose, not so much here, thank God, but all over the world. Just before Pesach, a lot of people got COVID. And one of the symptoms of COVID for a lot of people is you lose your taste. For a few weeks. You don't taste anything. Right? So the question arose about fulfilling the mitzvah of maror. Now, you can still eat the maror. It doesn't matter. It doesn't hurt. But the question is, you can't make a bracha, a blessing in God's name in vain if the mitzvah isn't done properly. So it was a whole question about the people who lost their taste over Pesach, whether they were allowed to make the blessing of Maror. Interesting question, right? but it was a discussed, there were a lot of halachic questions that arose out of COVID. What's that? There was a big, actually, dispute about it, but a lot of halachic authorities said they weren't. They ruled that they should eat it, but not make the blessing, or hear the blessing from someone else and just say amen or something. But they actually shouldn't make it themselves, right? Why am I mentioning that yet? Yeah, okay, well, that doesn't matter.
It was really not strong.
Yeah. Really, really mild. Sometimes that doesn't matter, halachically. It could be mild.
No, that's just interesting.
Our custom, for example, is we actually don't buy ground raw radish. We ground it ourselves, right? And I do it the day before Pesach, which makes it very strong.
Well, this year they're doing it at Tasmania.
Oh, really? Okay, well, I don't know if they're stronger there or weaker there. We'll find out.
This year they came, they do, do
Okay. But anyway, so I'm just saying this all because it highlights an important thing, right? It highlights this idea that the mitzvah of maror is you're supposed to taste it. You're supposed to feel it. What's the idea? So the spiritual idea is that you're supposed to feel discomfort. Because growth can only happen, freedom can only happen, number one, when you tap into the ability of freedom, the faith that you have, the soul that you have, the ability that you have, but also you have to recognize it as necessary. And we only recognize it as necessary to grow when we feel uncomfortable where we are now. Right? If we feel complacent, complacency is the antidote to growth. Right? The opposite of growth, right? The only way that we can grow is we don't feel complacent, which is the symbol of maror. That's why the two mitzvot go together. So therefore, we have to eat maror and Pesach, and also because we have to think about that concept of, not in a negative way, not in a guilt way, not in a destructive way, but in a healthy way. Feeling discomfort, as we've talked about many times, is a healthy thing. It's saying, look, my growth of last year was good, but it's no longer good. I need to take the next step, right? And it could even be that the growth we're talking about is growth out of what we grew last year, because we've said this many times. The exodus of last year is this year's Egypt, right? And we need to understand that, because growth is every year. We need to continuously grow. So therefore, we eat matzah to tap into that ability of growth, and we eat maror in order to get there, so we should feel uncomfortable where we are, so we can break through and be determined to actually grow. However, the third part of growth, of course, is we have to always understand that growth is hard work, right? And we have to be willing. Okay?
That's a
beeping noise. Oh, sorry. We have to be willing to put in the hard work. Right? Because true growth is a lot of hard work. What does that mean? So here's another interesting idea. What does growth mean? So we talked about it means going beyond our comfort zone, it means doing the right thing. But sometimes people think growth is staying away from what's bad. And that's not good enough. We let go of things that are destructive. Some people think, well, I'm a good person because I don't cheat. I don't lie. I'm not immoral. You see, that's all about what I don't do. Now, that could also be very difficult. That part of growth is also very difficult. But it's insufficient. Real growth means we have to go beyond who we are. We have to engage in something positive. What are we? Okay, so you don't do a number of things. What do you do? What do you do that's hard for you? What do you do to help other people? What do you do to strengthen your connection with God? What do you do to grow as a human being? Right? And this is also symbolized in Pesach. How so? You know, at the end of the meal, we eat the afikoma, right? That thing that the kids hide and we have to pay for to ransom. Right, so right now that's considered a very important part of the Seder. Why do we eat afikoman? Because actually, it's to remind us about in ancient times when there was a temple, how they used to eat the meat. They used to eat the meat of the Paschal lamb at the end of the meal. Now, normally meat is the main course, correct? But it wasn't with the Paschal lamb. Right, like the afikoman, it was eaten at the end of the meal. In fact, it was eaten as a dessert. I mean, one normally doesn't eat lettuce and lamb shashlik or whatever you call it at the end of the meal, but it was. That was the halakha. You had to eat at the end of the meal. In fact, you have to be full. You have to be satisfied already. And you're eating it as something extra. With the afikoman today, the same thing. We eat at the end of the meal. We eat the meal first, and then we eat the afikoman at the end, right? So we eat matzah for the mitzvah at the beginning of the meal, and then the afikoman at the end of the meal. Why? Because it tells us that growth is not enough just to stay away from evil. It's not even enough just to be a decent, good person. It has to be extra. So if you think you're full, now comes the extra part. It always has to be the little bit extra that you think you don't need. That's what growth is. And that's hard. And that's okay. Because that's true growth. True growth means, what am I doing extra? Now, with that halakha, it's interesting because it says you need to be full, but don't overeat before the afikoman, so you shouldn't be able to get it in, right? Because obviously we should have realistic expectations. We need to always go beyond our comfort zone, but not take on things that we know we can't. So it's a journey, and we do it step by step, and that's okay. We shouldn't be so full that we can't even get another piece of matzah in, but we need to be a little bit extra. So we need to be feel full, but then go the one step extra. And that's all part of growth. So maybe to wrap this up, I'm going to share with you how some of this is all reflected in another very important part of the Haggadah. And that is the four sons, right? Famous four sons of the Haggadah. So it says in the Torah, you're supposed to tell the story to your children. And it talks about four types of children. The Arba Banim, as it's called in the Haggadah. The wise, the wicked, the simple son, and the one that can't even ask questions. So one of the ideas behind the four sons is it actually creates a formula for our own growth. Because as some of the commentaries point out, you know, the whole mitzvah of the Haggadah, it's based on the pasuk, it's based on the verse, v'higadata levincha, you should tell your child, pass it on, right? What happens if someone is alone? Do they not need to do the Haggadah? And we talked about this last year, unfortunately, where a lot of people were alone. And the answer is no, you still need to say the Haggadah. So who are you saying it to? And who are you asking the questions to? And the answer is to yourself. Because there's the bincha, there's the son within ourselves, there's the child within us that we have to develop and we have to embrace and we have to welcome and we have to work with. And in fact, by extension, therefore, when the Torah talks about the four children, we need to know that we also have four children within ourselves. We all have the wise son, the wicked son, the simple son, and the son that can't ask any questions. And there's various ways to explain them, but let me just offer you one. And we have to talk to all four. We have to talk to the wise son within ourselves. Why? Because we have to answer the wise son's questions. We have to educate the wise son. Because part of growth is knowledge. Without growth, there cannot be knowledge. Now, the foundation of growth is the commitment, which comes from deeper than knowledge. It comes from, we talked about this at length, we spoke about it the other night. The ability to grow comes from something deeper than knowledge. It comes from conviction, it comes from selflessness, it comes from the depth of the soul. But where does it manifest itself? Where does freedom live? We know it lives in the brain, it lives in our intellect. It lives in the choices that we make, which are based on knowing what's wrong and what's right, knowing what's good for us long-term, what's not good for us long-term, what makes us a better person, what doesn't make us a better person, what makes us closer to spirituality and what doesn't make us closer to spirituality. For that, we need that pause that Stephen Covey talks about, to think, but you can't think if we don't know. Right? It's very simple. We can be committed. Okay, so I want to live a life of depth. I want to be beyond myself. I want to go beyond myself. I want to go out of my comfort zone. And therefore, I want to make good choices. But what are the good choices? If we don't educate ourselves, good choices are not just what people think are good choices. It's not just a subjective thing that every society decides what's good and what's bad. Good and bad is intrinsic a lot of the time. And therefore, we need to educate ourselves. We need to educate ourselves on ethical behavior, spiritual behavior. What does it mean? What is good and bad? What is the right thing to do? What are the good choices to make in life? So that's the first child we need to talk to, the chacham. We need to welcome that wise part of us, the ability to have intellect, the ability to think, the ability to learn and to educate into the Seder process, into our journey of growth, because that's such an important part of the journey towards inner freedom. That's number one. Number two, we have to embrace the wicked son. Now that's very, very important. We all have a wicked son. Why? Because we all have struggles. We all have the parts of us that are problematic, right? And we have to embrace that son. We must not be put off by the fact that we have struggle. Because we have to celebrate the fact that we have struggle. What do I mean? We don't look for struggle, but we all have struggle, as we said many times. You know, it's interesting. If you look carefully at the Haggadah, what is the question of the wicked son? He's deemed to be very provoking. What does he say that's so bad? Okay, that's one thing. But he actually, the commentaries point out another thing he says. Because he kind of asks a similar question to the wise son. Right? The wise son also says, what are all these things that you're doing? And he says also, what's this to you? Ma'avodah zot lachem. What are you doing all these rituals for? Right? Okay, so there's a lot written about to distinguish between the wise son and the wicked son. But one of the ideas is, the wording. The chacham is not afraid of hard work. The chacham says, I just want to understand what this is all about. The rasha, the wicked son, says, Maha Avodah, what are you driving? Are you mad? Like, what are you every year, pots in, pots out, changing over, getting rid of the bread, working hard? Everyone comes to the Seder, as I say in Yiddish, Uiz Gemutschet, you're completely exhausted. What do you need this for? Right? And that's precisely what we have to welcome, we have to explain to the Rasha. It is all about avodah, it's all about hard work. Because that's what makes a good human being, to struggle, to embrace struggle. And struggle means that we might not win some of the times, but that doesn't matter. God wants us to try, He wants us to overcome, He wants to take one step forward, right? We're not perfect human beings, that's the idea. But we do need to engage. We do need to try. We do need to put in the work. And that's why we need to recognize that part of us is part of the Seder. That resistance to working is part of the Seder. That struggle is part of the Seder. We need to embrace it and work with it and put a bit of work into it and explain to it that it needs to work hard. That the struggle is not a problem that he's a Rasha. The problem is he doesn't want to work. That's the problem. You don't want to put in the effort. That's the problem. If you don't want to work hard, then we lost. There's a few things that will hold us back. Complacency is one of them. Ego is another. And the resistance to effort. If you're not willing to put in the work, it's not going to happen. That's why the Rasha is such an important part of the Seder. The Tam, the simple son. So the truth is, the simple son, if you just read the Agadah, seems very naive and simple. The Kabbalists say that the Tam is the greatest child of all. He's deeper than the Chacham. Chacham is about knowledge. The Tam is that selflessness, that like the Matzah, the purity of the soul, which you have to connect to by the Seder. Knowledge is critical, but knowledge itself is dangerous. Because if it's based and guided by egocentricity, then you'll rationalize anything. You need the Tam, you need this pure sun. We need to connect to the purity of the soul. And the last one is an interesting one, it's the sun that cannot ask. What does that mean? So the commentaries explain that represents another very important part of the puzzle, and that is surrender. That sometimes we have to surrender. It's the other side of the Chacham. The Chacham is about education, understanding, internalizing, which is a critical part of the journey. But we also have to understand the limitation and the finiteness of our own knowledge. And therefore, sometimes when we don't understand, it stands in the way. Not a very popular concept today. Today it's all about understanding everything and rationalizing everything. And if it doesn't talk to me and if it doesn't fit with my way of looking at the world, then it's a problem. We need to understand that that's not going to get us anywhere. What is going to bring growth is a little bit of surrender. To understand that we don't understand. There's sometimes that we can't even ask the question. Yeah.
Is that emunah?
That's true emunah, exactly. Yeah. That's true emunah. It's applied emunah. It's saying, look, I mean, understanding that we... So the Tam is more about the purity of the soul that allows us to grow, the infinity, the strength. This is about emunah, yes. So in other words, it's knowing that sometimes we have questions and sometimes... We don't know the answers, nor do we want to know the answers, and sometimes we don't even know what to ask, but that's all right. Asking is very important. We have the Chacham, but we also have the one who can't ask questions, and that's an important part of the growth journey as well. To understand that sometimes we just have to accept, and we have to wait for guidance. Like it says in the Haggadah, that the one who can't ask the questions, you have to guide them. And in our relationship with God, that's God guiding us, and we're just surrendering. And surrender, people look at it as a weakness, but actually surrender is a strength. Not if you do it all the time, but it surrenders a strength because it's surrendering to something deeper, something higher. It's recognizing our own limitation and surrendering something which is far greater than ourselves. Just because we have a few minutes, I'll just end off with one final point, which is similar concept, but it also fits in very beautifully to a very central part of the Seder, and that's, I'm going to quote the source, Rabbi Moss wrote about this a few years ago very beautifully in one of his articles, and I'm going to share it with you. It's written in different commentaries, but he brought it out very sort of systematically. And that's the four questions. Four questions, Manishtana, right? So the Manishtana is a very interesting paragraph. It's the idea of having questions and answers and so on. There's lots to talk about. But if you look at the format, it's interesting. It could be read two ways. The Manishtana starts with a sentence. It says, Manishtana halayla hazeh mikol halilot. Like an introductory question. Why is this night different to all other nights? And then we go, 1, 2, 3, 4. All the nights, we eat chametz. Tonight, we all need matz. All the night. So it's not actually worded as four questions. It's kind of worded as one question with four details, right? Or, alternatively, one way to read the Manishtana, not the simple way, but an alternative way to read it, is one question with four answers. That actually they're not questions, they're answers. The question is, Manishtana halayla hazeh mikol halilot. Why is this night so different to all other nights? What's the energy of this night? What's the depth of this night? How do I connect to the holiness of this night? How do I use this night out as a true journey of freedom and inner growth? Right? And the Haggadah gives us four answers. We need to think about four things which are connected to everything we spoke about for the last hour. First of all, tonight we only eat matzah. Tonight we connect to selflessness, to purity, to emunah, to faith. We dig deep and we find that part of ourselves that's going to facilitate going beyond ourselves and freeing ourselves from ourselves and experiencing true growth. Secondly, we say, and all the night we eat vegetables, tonight we eat bitter vegetables. Because we recognize that part of the formula of tonight is to feel the discomfort of where we are, not to be complacent, and to resolve and to reflect about taking the new step. And all the nights we don't dip, but tonight we dip twice. That's an important one. Dipping is a sign of immersion, engaging. It's like the ultimate of Jewish mindfulness. In other words, if you want to experience Pesach, you want to get out of Pesach, the depth of what Pesach is, we need to be present at the Seder. We need to be really engaged. We need to come armed with a few ideas that you can discuss with your family, make it meaningful. Discuss what they mean, discuss what freedom is, discuss how we can grow, discuss different opportunities, different suggestions. We dip not only once, we dip twice, we get involved. We don't stand at a distance. Any experience, but especially Pesach, if we're spectators at the Seder, if we're just spectators and stand on the side, we're not going to get what we need to get out of it. Obviously, we always get something out of it, but not what we need to get out of it. We need to dip. And finally, we say, the fourth answer is we don't always lean, but tonight we lean. What is leaning? Leaning is a sign of confidence, sign of royalty. When you're truly free, true. It's the confidence that we talked about before. It's believing that we can grow, that we can do it. So that's a little bit about the depth of the Seder night, but the way it works in Judaism always is a combination of two things. To really experience it, or to try and taste it at least, and experience it on some level, it's always a combination of two things. One is the action, because in Judaism, the energy is through the action. How do we tap into that great energy? It's through the action, it's through actually eating the matzah, eating the maror, drinking the four cups, and so on and so forth. And then of course, but not just doing the action, it's about reflecting what that action represents, and trying to reflect on it and experience it as we go along. Yeah. So matzah, that's emunah, we spoke about before. It's about connecting to the depth of our soul, right? So once again, in terms of the action, if anyone needs shmur matzah, please see me. And just once again, the next Thursday morning will take place the 15th of April. I want to wish everyone a Chag Sameach and a meaningful and deep Pesach.
And to you. Thank you.
Thank you.